Greetings, Professor Falcon.
Hello, Joshua.
Strange game. The only winning move is not to play. How about a nice game of chess?
Colonel Conley, take us to DEFCON 5.
Yes, sir.
Welcome to Retro Rockets. I'm your host, Andrea Johnson. My guests today are Chris M. Barkley and Jason Sanford. Chris recently won the Hugo Award for Best Fan Writer. Today's episode is being recorded on February 17, 2024. Chris and Jason have co-written extensive reporting about the apparent censorship affecting who and who did not make the Hugo ballot in 2023 at the Chengdu Worldcon in China. This is a developing story, and more information may have come out by the time this episode airs. Chris and Jason's reporting is primarily available at file770.com. Gentlemen, can you introduce yourselves to our listeners?
Again, Jason Sanford. I report on the science fiction fantasy genre through my genre grapevine column. I've been a finalist for the Hugo Award for Best Fan Writer three times. Got beat by Chris last year. Thank you, Chris. Oh. I love that. But I'm also a science fiction writer. I think it's four times now, a finalist for the Nebula, including for my novel Plague Birds, which was finalist for the Nebula Award for Best Novel and the Philip K. Dick Award.
And Chris?
And I'm Chris Barkley. I live in Cincinnati, Ohio. I was a Hugo Award finalist in 2022 and last year for Best Fan Writer. I mainly correspond for file770.com and my editor, Mike Glyer, who is a multiple Hugo Award winner. I've been writing since 1974 when I was a reporter for my college newspaper. And I've been a regular contributor to file770 since 1997.
Thank you so much. Let's dive right in. I know you've both done extensive research on what occurred leading up to Chengdu Worldcon, and it feels like more information is coming out on a near daily basis, and it is a lot. But I do have listeners that may not have been following this. So can you quickly bring us up to speed?
Well, I'll start. Originally, I was going to a convention at the beginning of the month called Capricorn number 44, mainly because a friend of mine has been ill and we were throwing a party for her. But before I left to go to the party, a friend of mine, Diane Lacey, reached out to me and said, I'd like to talk. And I said, oh, certainly. She said she was going to come to the convention. And this all happened in the wake of Dave McCarty releasing the Hugo nomination long list. I reached out to him to see if I can get an interview with him at the same convention since he lives in Chicago too. So it was only going to be a 1.5 day trip. Went up Saturday, met with Diane first. We had lunch and she gave me emails and spreadsheets about what happened. Now, at the time, she was very, very upset, and she said that she had also written an apology letter. And I said, okay. And she was very emotionally wrought because she knew that once this came out, it would be like a thermonuclear explosion in fandom. I refrained from either reading the spreadsheets or the emails until I got home Sunday. Now, in the meantime, circling back a bit, as I was going to leave the convention Sunday morning, Dave asked me, hey, you want to do an interview? And I said, of course. And we sat down for about 45 minutes. And I've heard some people say that I tossed him a lot of softball questions. I can't be objective about that. I thought they were fair questions. But the main reason I wanted to do the interview was to try to draw him out. And since we had been friends for decades, I thought he might be a little more forthcoming with me than with anyone else. And as anybody who's read the transcript or actually heard the interview, he was not very forthcoming, which is too bad. Now, if I had read the emails that evening before the interview, I don't think I would have changed the interview a bit, because he's obviously the center of this controversy. And I wanted to give him every opportunity to just tell me what happened.
And where's the, where's the interview or the transcript posted at?
That would be, you can find it on file 770. And I think Jason has a copy too.
Yeah, you can also, we link to it from our main report on what all we discovered in those emails that Chris is talking about. Mm-hmm.
So I get back Sunday evening. My partner, Julius, helped me immensely in this endeavor. She read them first and she said, whoa. And then I read them. And then I saw the dossiers, myself, Jason, Paul Weimer, and I said, this is incredible. And I knew Monday morning I had to write about it, but I don't think I had the resources to do it by myself. So I reached out to Jason, and I just want to point out that Jason and I have been praised for writing up this report, but the most amazing thing is that we're in the story. And I think Jason can attest to this. We never want to be the center of a story or a subject of a story. So we were walking a tightrope on this for 2 weeks, trying to remain objective and just keeping all of our feelings about this in our conclusions. So,
yeah.
How do you write objectively when, not only because both of you are in the story, but there's a lot of very large emotions and feelings wrapped up in this?
Yeah.
Well, I can tell the kids at home, if you're in a situation like this, do not write when you're angry, because Jason pointed out a piece that I had written in my in the body of the story, which we kept to third person, which gave us a little emotional distance. He pointed out a section, says, you know what, Chris, I think that's kind of like editorial type writing. And I looked and says, you are absolutely correct.
Yes.
So after that, I had to do a little course correction on my own feelings about this. Jason, you want to pick up?
Yeah, and that's actually one reason how we pulled the report together as we did. You know, obviously, we both were involved in the story because they created political dossiers on each of us, and we couldn't ignore that. But we did. We also felt that this was a story that we could cover in a better way than and perhaps a more mainstream media journalist, because they wouldn't know the genre like we did. So one of the reasons when you look at the report, you've got Chris wrote the introduction, which both is from a personal point of view, but also gives a good summary of all that had happened up there. Then our main report is very, you know, third person journalistic style report, heavily, you know, it doesn't go beyond what the evidence says, but we also wanted to share our personal opinion. So we do have each presented our own conclusions and observations from our point of views at the end of the report. I think it worked well, you know. You know, if we tried mixing all that together, the personal and with the evidence and stuff like that, it would have undermined it some. It was interesting to say the least, because as we were working on it, the story was also developing, and then when we had to reach out to the people for comment, Dave had commented. And as we all know, Dave has commented at length on a lot of this, just not saying much. But when we had to reach out to Cat Jones, we had, you know, we're like, okay, this is probably going to blow open. And it did. Let's just say, we don't want to go into too much behind the scenes there, but there was some Dave McCarty found out, it appears, and we, you know, there seemed to be a lot swirling around, so we were really having to hustle at the end there to get it out. I think then, but we also knew it was going to be a big story, so we wanted to make sure it was very accurate. Mm-hmm. You know, we kept going back and forth on the evidence and, you know, Chris, is this right? Chris B. Jason, is this right? You know, is this correct? Is this correct? You know, drilling down, making sure that we had what we had. I would love to have more evidence, but what we had was pretty explosive, but we had to go with what we had, and we had to be accurate and honest and present exactly what it said.
Right. And this was when it really started to boil over, when Dave McCarty found out, was a Wednesday morning, Wednesday afternoon.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, my socials were going crazy.
Yeah. We had planned on publishing on a Thursday or a Friday, but we just put the foot down on the accelerator, and we, by some miracle, got our final draft to Mike Glier. He went over it. He had a few questions and a few edit mm-hmm. changes, and we said fine. And at 9 p.m. on Wednesday, it went out.
I the next morning, I texted he won't say it. A friend of mine, Maurice Broaddus. And I texted him, you know, when I woke up, I said, hey, Maurice, I kind of dropped a genre on Thursday morning. I texted him. I said, Maurice, I think I dropped a bomb on the genre last night, then went to bed. And he's like, oh, yes, I noticed. We were all up all night. Thank you.
It was I usually go to bed around 9:30, 10 o'clock. And it was very mm-hmm. difficult that evening because everything was just thread upon thread upon thread upon thread.
Yeah.
Yeah, I stayed up until 11 p.m. and then I put my phone on the charger and I turned it completely off. It says, I can't deal with it anymore. Thank you very much.
Yeah, I kind of had the flu. So at 9:15, I was like, well, it's out there. It's done. I'm going to bed. Even though I was like, we'll see how it is in the morning.
And Jason ought to be commended. Jason ought to be commended because he started getting sick on Monday. And he just powered through.
Wow.
I mean, if I'm like the architect of the story, he actually built it. He actually built the foundation that I built upon. So kudos to Jason for that.
Well, kudos to you, Chris. I want to emphasize that Chris brought to the project not only his, you know, many decades in the genre and knowledge, but all the, you know, relationships matter in this kind of thing. And, you know, Diane leaked the emails and all the information that she shared because of her relationship with Chris. And that's why.
Yeah. And Chris, she felt comfortable coming to you.
Yeah.
Well, I had broken a few other stories on File 770, like the CIFWA Mercedes Lackeys incident. And I got inside information on that. So, and I've never revealed the source of where that came from, sources. And people read me, and I have a hard time gauging whether people have actually been reading my column. I've been doing it for about 6 or 7 years now, but apparently people are, and people approach me all the time. Saying what a good job I did, and I try to keep my head down and say thank you very much. So I try to engender the trust of friends or just acquaintances who want to tell me things, because as journalists we're not out to coerce stories. We're here to listen and document and convey.
Yeah. And I think actually both of us working on it, and both me through my genre grapevine and Chris through File 770, added some gravitas to the report when people saw that, oh crap, it's coming out from both of them.
Yeah, it's like, that's heavy coming out from both of you at the same time.
Exactly.
Jason, can you give us some background? Like we're talking in details. We're talking about what happened. What exactly happened?
Exactly. So last year, the World Science Fiction Convention was held in Chengdu, China. traditionally, not just traditionally, but under the rules of the World Science Fiction Society, which runs, is over overall, is supposed to be in charge of all the Worldcon. The Hugos are run and managed by each local Worldcon. So that meant the Chengdu Worldcon would be running the Hugo Awards. The Worldcon, it went off. Everything seemed to be good. There'd been some questions when the Hugo finalists were announced. There were a few shockers that were not finalists. For example, Babel by R.F. Kuang was not a finalist. And that was very shocking because the novel had won the Nebula Award and the Locus Award. And it was seen, I mean, it wasn't just a well-written novel that didn't get a lot of readers. The book sold, like, I think, over 330,000 copies in hardback. So it was very well read. But that was like, huh, interesting. And then in January 20th, under the rules of the World Science Fiction Society, the Nebula statistics are supposed to be released within 90 days of the Hugo presentation. They're almost always released that night, a few days later at most. And these are the not only the how the votes went for the finalists and who won overall, but it also shows you the long list, all the nominees that came close. And when it came out, there are all these works that had been declared not eligible.
All I can think of for not eligible is like perhaps it was published a year early or something like that.
And there were a few cases that where it said that this was not eligible because it had been published previously. That every other time that has happened in Hugo history, it is explained what happened, why it's not eligible. And so, or maybe the author withdrew. Again, the stats that were released had a few authors that withdrew. Dave McCarthy, Cardi was the overall Hugo administrator. Dave is from the United States. Dave gave basically saying, well, we followed the rules and the laws, and that's all I'm going to tell you. And people just got mad. It was like, Dave, what's going on? You can't just
That's not an explanation.
Babel. Right. Babel, one of the most acclaimed genre novels of probably the last decade, was just not eligible. And it won the Nebula Award for Best Novel. Come on. And then, you know, there were suspicions that there was censorship going on there. Well,
rightfully so.
What our report covered. Our report turns out that there was censorship. However, the censorship seems to have been led with political research by the administrators of the Hugos from the United States and Canada.
See, that's weird.
In other words, the phone call was coming from inside the house.
Mm-hmm.
Weird and awful.
You know, now we can't say whether it was administrators from the United States and Canada, longtime genre people, they did this. Now, still, we cannot prove whether there was hard or soft censorship that they were working under from China. You know, whether the Chinese government had said, do this. Probably the suspicion is that it was more soft censorship, like in China, that's kind of like, hey, you know what you're not supposed to say. So, but the evidence we have is like, again, the administrators from the United States and Canada were the one doing it. And it's just, and that's basically what the report is about. And just, it goes into, we have the emails, we have the validation report that shows that how they were tracking the political coverage. There's a lot more that could come out. For example, it turns out there were a ton of Chinese works that were removed from the ballot, supposedly because of a slate voting, but it's questionable if there was a slate now. It's looking like Science Fiction World, the biggest science fiction magazine in the world out of China, had run a recommendation list. Hey, y'all check out these works for the award.
People run recommendations. Yeah, people run recommendation lists all the time.
And if those slated works had not been removed, you would have seen a ton of Chinese works on the final ballot. So there's a lot more that happened here that is, we don't know exactly what went down, but let's just say there's more to come, I would imagine.
And I just want to say that I was invited by the Chengdu Science Fiction Society and the convention committee of the Worldcon to attend, since I was a nominee. And I went without any promises of what I would say, what I would do, or anything I could see. And for the most part, that was exactly what happened. But I had my eyes and ears open, because when the original nomination list came out, and my name and Jason's and Paul Weimer, Bitter Corella, and others were on the fan writer list, I said, so why aren't there more Chinese nominees on this list? So I suspected something was going on, because I had fully expected the entire nomination list for last year to have more Chinese.
That's what I expected too. Was I was very shocked to see the ballot when it came out, and to see so much English language work on it.
I mean, thank goodness there were Chinese winners. I do have to point out, though, that when Paul Weimer and his nomination were pulled from the list, another writer, Arthur Liu, moved up, and so there were two Chinese writers. I think that was collateral damage, so to speak, to have two Chinese writers. And I fully expected either Arthur or River Flow to win. And if you look at the vote distribution, I led in all six rounds. And after Arthur Liu votes were distributed, River Flow picked up a lot more votes, but came up one short. Now, I'm hypothesizing here, if Paul Weimer is on the list, I think River Flow not only wins Best Fanzine as an editor, he's also going to win Best Fan Writer. Mm-hmm. So my Hugo may have an asterisk by it, but I entirely believe that River Flow would have won that Hugo.
Yeah, well, the saddest thing is how this has hurt not only fandom in the United States, but also in China.
Yeah, I want to talk about that a little bit. There's been a number of reactions from fans and fan groups in China. Can you speak a little bit to some of the Chinese reaction?
We reached out. We tried to get comments directly from Chinese fans. We were not able to do that. We did get some comments from people who were in connection with Chinese fans, who basically, there was some posting that we saw when all this first came out, too. Translations of what was on social media in China from fans there. And people there appear to be very upset about it, too. That's the thing to understand. That's one reason I keep saying the administrators were from the United States and Canada, is that initially when all this happened, when it was like, hey, it looks like there was censorship, people were like, well, what did you expect? It was in China.
I've heard that a lot.
And, okay, there's issues with the Chinese government. Absolutely. Okay. Come on. I mean, you know, but the people doing this that screwed all this up, that with the evidence we have, were the people from here. And then that made the problem is, though, then the Chengdu Worldcon was run, you know, it was for the benefit of the fans in China and fans around the world. And while I have major issues with the Chinese government, I want there to be relationships between the Chinese science fiction and fantasy fans and American and Western science fiction and fantasy fans. Connections are how we change the world, okay? You know, we can, I think that's a force for good. And this, you know, yes, there were other issues with Worldcon in China. You know, there was money, a lot of business deals going on, stuff like that. But this coming out hurt the fans, and that's what you have been hearing coming out of Chinese fandom. I know when the Guardian newspaper, they were able to translate some fan comments that were posted on Weibo after our report came out. And yeah, and the fans, they were mad about it. And, you know, they're upset too. And like I said, I'm curious to see what all these Chinese works that were removed because they were slating. They were on a slate. Why the heck did that happen? That's another reason we released that validation spreadsheet, so people could see what some of these Chinese works were that were removed. We can't say why they were removed for certain, but there were so many on there, and it was like, wow, I'd love to read those. I'd love to have more about that.
I want to read those.
I want to read those works. I want to translate.
I want those writers to to feel safe and comfortable attending future Worldcons.
Exactly.
I want those fans to feel safe and comfortable attending future Worldcons and interacting with American, you know, and English speaking fans.
Yes. As somebody who was actually there, I was overwhelmed by not only the Chinese fans' enthusiasm, but their willingness to come up to a foreigner like myself. And they don't see foreigners, especially foreigners of color, all that often, just walking around China. And they were so open and friendly and engaging. And I started a few friendships myself. And when I hear about these reactions coming out of China, I said, this is very disappointing for them. Mm-hmm. And, I'm just more than a bit enraged that people who could have been nominated, could have been on the list, and could have had a piece of prestige have been robbed, at least this year, of having that kind of worldwide exposure.
I'd like to just quote that comment that the Guardian newspaper had from a Chinese fan on Weibo. The quote was, the translation, Diane Lacey's courage to disclose the truth makes people feel there is still hope in the world and not everyone is shameless. The comment closed by saying, I think the Hugo committee were cowards. So basically they were saying the same thing we're saying here.
Right.
You know,
yeah,
so
we're all on the same side.
Exactly. We love the genre. We love science fiction, fantasy. Let's build connections when we can. We're not going to ignore stuff when it happens, which is one reason we wrote this report.
We would be nowhere at all without the courage and conviction of Diane Lacey, who mm-hmm. realized probably mid or half, you know, halfway through this process, this is wrong. But she must be commended highly mm-hmm. and profusely and repeatedly for her courage, because when I met her and she was in this highly emotional state that this was going to ruin her life mm-hmm. and that people would hate her. And I said, no, you are doing the right thing.
Yeah.
And I just tried to reassure her throughout the entire process of the writing of this, mm-hmm. because we had to go back to her repeatedly for details mm-hmm. or
confirmation.
Or testimony. Yes. Confirmation and testimony. And she did. And she did unflinchingly. So
that is courage.
That is courage. I mean, what we did was just tell her story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, and if I can get on my soapbox a bit, I've been in the genre a while, not as long as Chris. I grew up loving science fiction and fantasy. And one thing, you know, you've run into all the time in the genre is free speech. And it's pushed so far. Like you get people who say, well, I'm just telling you, it's free speech. I'm just telling you how it is. They use that as an excuse to do stuff. You're like, why'd you do that? But here's an actual case where we had people in our genre fandom who had a chance to stand up for free speech, and they didn't. Now, Diane did. Yes. Thank you, Diane.
But other people had that opportunity, and they didn't.
I mean, it's a very sad situation. Since we actually, Jason and I either know of or actually know some of the people involved here, I've been in fandom since June of 1976, which is 48 plus years. And I have never, ever had a situation like this come up or have something of this seismic effect happen in fandom. I think it's a bad thing for fandom. But the way forward is to seek out the truth.
Yeah, how does fandom recover from this? How do future Worldcon committees avoid this?
Well, Jason and I have a few ideas.
And they are?
One of the suggestions I made after the announcement on January 20th was that the World Science Fiction Society Constitution should adopt the UN Declaration of Human Rights. Not only that, but anyone who wants to bid on a future Worldcon has to sign a legal affidavit saying that they would abide by the Declaration of Human Rights.
Exactly. Basically.
And if they and if a convention committee does not want to sign on, they will not be allowed to bid.
Yeah. And there's also, I think, I know Chris wrote a has written about this, and so have others in the genre. The Hugo Awards need to be spun off and separated from Worldcon. Each Worldcon should not be the ones that run the Hugo Awards. They can be involved in the presenting and stuff, but you have to have them spun off from Worldcon. And as part of that, it's come out in all this, the World Science Fiction Society that run that is overall supposed to be in charge of Worldcon is a paper tiger. They have no strength to enforce what they're supposed to enforce. They need to incorporate, like every other big convention in the world. They're going to have to incorporate and have power over the local world cons each year.
Talk to me more about this, about spinning the Hugo Awards off from Worldcon. This is something that I have to explain over and over and over again to my friends and family who are not involved in genre and not involved in fandom, that wherever the Worldcon happens to be that year, because it moves around the world, it's a completely new and different group of organizers who are all volunteers and have hopefully done this before.
Mm-hmm. Some of them have, and some of them haven't. For instance, the group in Chicago has put on 8 Worldcons, or rather groups in Chicago put on 8 Worldcons. The convention coming up in Glasgow, I think this is their second or third time around, but they have workers, people who live not only here but overseas, who are involved with the Worldcon every year. Now, Seattle, on the other hand, is running it for the first time, and it's practically a grand new group of people. And they're paying attention very closely to all these events because they don't want these problems happening on their watch.
Exactly. And, for example, Dave McCarthy had previously been the overall administrator for the Hugo Awards. I believe, when was the last time, Chris? 2014 or 2015?
He's actually been an administrator several times between 2014. And last year.
The reason I mentioned 2014, he was the administrator in charge during the Sad Puppies.
Yes.
Which, and I'm going to throw this out there since, we didn't. It was ironic then we had slating and the overall Worldcon, Hugo Awards administrator decided.
They were fine with it.
We were going to remove people for slating. But this year in China, there was, quote, supposedly slating. And the decision was we remove these works.
That makes no sense, but it's...
No, it just makes... Of course not. And the rules didn't change. The rules did not change.
And I remember 2014, and it was not fun.
Well, neither was 2015 when actual puppies appeared on the ballot. 2015 was in Spokane.
But I remember reading a number of those works. I just don't remember what year it was. Reading because they were on the ballot, not because I went out of my way to read some of those. Did not.
It was the 2015 Hugos. Okay. That's when the Sad Puppies really hit. But, and that's kind of the thing is, though, that's what we're seeing now is that, and that's what Dave McCarthy kept saying over and over. Well, basically, I'm the administrator, whatever I say. He didn't say this directly, so there's not a quote. But he seemed to be implying, whatever I say is correct as the administrator.
That's not how this works.
No. That's not how this works.
No.
And we need to change it so that there is Paul Weimer made a great point. He says in our article, we quote him, it says, we need third party, verification of all this stuff. People need to be able to trust the Hugo Award. Transparency. And I will say, let me do one thing to know is, if something like this had happened with any other major literary award in the world, you would not know about it because they're not very transparent. For all the faults of what has happened here, the Hugo Awards are one of the most transparent literary and awards in the world. Mm. And we were able to figure all this out because of that transparency. Even with the manipulation and everything, it couldn't hide what had happened eventually. Actually, so that is a good thing, and we need to keep that. But it,
but like third-party monitoring exists for a reason.
Right. I just want to correct Jason. There actually was a bit of a scandal involving the Nobel Prizes about 4 or 5 years ago. In fact, the scandal, which involved a couple of people who either knew about nominees or was leaking results in advance, something like that, or had a personal connection, they didn't award the Nobel Prizes for 1 year because of that. And
they just skipped
it. Their system is still opaque. Nobody knows what goes on.
There's always literary scandals. It's just, it helps having the transparency of the Hugo. So that is a good thing.
Well, I just wanted to say, it wouldn't be the worst thing in the world if the Hugo Awards were separated from the control of...
I agree completely.
Committees ...and have them presented like the National Book Award or the Pulitzer Prizes.
So this may be a moot point as we're discussing, hey, how do we separate these two things? But just for kind of my education, I'm interested in... can you speak real briefly, like, how do Worldcon bids work? Like, how is it decided what country and city a Worldcon is going to be in? And what happens if a location wins a bid and then it is determined that country, for example, is not friendly to gay people? That country is not friendly to people of a specific religion? What do you do?
I'm going to leave this one to Chris because he's better at this kind of stuff at the Worldcon. Well,
so the World Science Fiction Convention started in 1939 when a group of New York area fans decided to hold a nationwide convention. They happened to call it the World Science Fiction Convention because it was also happening in conjunction with the World's Fair of 1939.
So that's the connection.
That's a connection. Now, from then on until the start of World War II, that's 1941, the fans just decided among themselves which city would host a Worldcon. So the 1940 convention was in Chicago. The 1941 convention was in Denver. And then World War II started, and conventions picked back again, I think, with Los Angeles in 1946. Now, as time went on, people... and the convention got a bit larger. People wanted to make the convention more open to other cities. So they set up what they called site selection. So somewhere along the line, people started voting for site selection. And usually in the 50s and 60s, it was a year's advance. But as hotel contracts...
You have to go 2 years in advance now.
You had to go...
Or no, more. Actually,
for a while, it was 3 years in advance. And I think about maybe 20 years ago, they decided to go 2 years in advance. So site selection happens when fans get together at a Worldcon. They usually vote in advance. And you vote a voting fee, and those fees go to the winning bid. If there are more bidders, then they hold parties throughout the election period, and they have parties.
They'll hold events at other regional conventions.
Exactly, to gather in support, and all that money goes towards the eventual winner of the Worldcon. What else about the process?
Did Chengdu hold some really kick-ass parties?
Here's what happened. Back in the mid, about 7 or 8 years ago, or further back, Chinese fans started coming to Worldcons, and they said that we'd like to do this too. So they've been shadowing Worldcon committees and working at conventions to find out how to do this. And they opened up a actual bid, I think, in 2018, and they were shooting for 2023. So in 2021, where the voting was going to take place, which happened to be Washington, D.C. during the COVID period, Apparently, the Chinese bidders did a lot of campaigning and got a substantial number of people to vote for the Chengdu Worldcon. What a controversy involving that vote came up was that they perceive the term address differently than we do. Usually, bidders require names and addresses, like in home addresses. In China, an address, as far as they're concerned, they don't give home addresses, they use email addresses. So that was a sticking point when they, when the ballots were counted. There were some objection from Western fans saying, hey,
you have no home addresses on here.
There are no physical addresses here. And the ruling of the business meeting and the convention committee was, well, they perceive it differently, so we're going to allow it. And it was an overwhelming vote for Chengdu. They won something like 1,800 to 800 for the losing bid, Winnipeg.
Wow. That is a big difference in votes.
Right.
Yeah. And the thing is that then there was an attempt to throw out the votes, like Chris was saying, but you know, the Chengdu bid had been done under the current rules of the Worldcon, of the World Science Fiction Society. You know, and it was at the time I was like, well, you know, hey, they followed the rules. Yes, there are major issues with the Chinese government, but if we go in and throw out these under, you know, just say we don't like the outcome, we're going to throw, it's the same thing as what we would be complaining about now with the, we are with the Hugos. It's like, you've got to follow the rules on this kind of stuff, you know, and you need to make it as transparent and all that kind of, but Worldcon again is about building connections around the world, ideally. And so, I'm glad the decision went ahead, because if it had been revoked that way, that would have, I think, damaged relationships between fans and China and the United States and Europe horribly. You know what I mean? So even more worse than what was happening now with the Hugo revelations.
Yeah. And I'd like to point out that currently, as of today, under the Constitution of the World Science Fiction Society, Russia could bid. Israel has an active bid for 2027. And other undesirable places like Hungary, they could bid for Worldcon and win.
Yeah, I mean, now, any area can bid, right?
Yeah,
can say, exactly. Hey, we're interested in entering into this, and you right. know, what are fans to do,
well,
when it's announced, hey, yeah. we're holding a Worldcon in this undesirable location?
Yeah, some people that I know have tried to say there have got to be some kind of limits on where a Worldcon could be held. And some people actually want to ban actual and name actual countries as non-starters for bidders. I don't think that's the right way to go about this. I think that some of the solutions that Jason and I have put forward would probably make fans aware that, you know, there are some places that we really shouldn't hold a Worldcon, but we're leaving that vote up to fans and not to bureaucrats or administrators.
Yeah, and it'll come up at the Worldcon in Glasgow, Scotland later this year. During the business meetings, which are just, they're so much fun. And, you know, that's why everyone goes to Worldcon, is to sit in a business meeting for multiple days. But I think this time, because of what has happened, you will have enough people doing it that they will start the process to change all this.
And let there be no mistake about it, there's going to be some vigorous, loud, angry debate about this. I myself was involved with the business meeting between 1999 and 2019. And I acrimoniously left dealing with the business meeting because it got to a point where I don't think that anyone was actually listening to what I was saying to either make changes to the Hugo Awards or some administrative processes. And once that happened, I had to walk away. However, I do still approve of the process. It's just a bit of a slog. And after a while, can it take an emotional toll on you?
And you did it for so many years that it is commendable that you were involved for so many years, and understandable that after a while it was just emotionally exhausting. Mm.
If I do attend in Glasgow, I will go to the business meeting and I will vote for what I think are appropriate changes. I should tell your listeners that it's a two-step process. If you pass a piece of legislation to change the Constitution, it has to pass twice, at the convention where it was presented and the next convention where it will be ratified.
Does that allow time for people to talk about it, or is it just kind of an administrative rule?
Oh, no.
Okay.
Oh, go ahead, Chris.
Yeah. It's standard procedure mm-hmm. for a 2-year ratification process.
Okay.
I think it's in my cynical side, I think part of the World Science Fiction Society's constitution is set up to keep people from making change that might be for the benefit of, expanding. I don't know. I better shut up.
No, please do not shut up.
No. Jason's correct. It is set up to, it's like, well, let's take the United States Constitution. Anybody can look up the rules regarding that. And yeah, it's pretty tough to get an amendment passed, but it's not impossible.
And it has happened.
And I would like to say I proudly shepherded through several amendments over that 20-year period, including splitting the best dramatic presentation Hugo, the editing Hugo, and starting a Hugo up for comics, manga, and graphic stories. It can be done.
It can be done, and you were part of doing it.
Yes, I was.
But you got to have that momentum and keep it.
Right.
And that's what we do have right now. Let's be honest. The last time the Hugo Awards, let's be honest, there's always talk about, oh, the Hugo Awards are not fair. They're biased. They're dead. You know, the Hugo Awards are dead people have been saying that for decades. The last time somebody tried to manipulate the Hugo Awards was the Sad Puppies affair. And the genre came through and made changes to make it where it's hard for slates to be able to do what they were trying to do. So the genre loves the Hugo Awards. Yes, they had their faults. The Hugos have been, over the years, there's a lot of political games. Sometimes they just seem like a popularity contest, but spoilers, everything in life, in human life, is a popularity contest, one degree or another, especially awards. They left people out who should be in. They put people on the ballot you wonder why the heck that work got awarded. You know, they've been exclusionary. You know, they've kept people of color out for too many years. There's been all these issues, but the genre has tried to improve them. And the awards are still the most visible aspect of the science fiction fantasy literary genre. If you see a book that has a Hugo Award finalist or winner on it, people will check it out. People outside the genre will check it out. You know, so we don't want to lose the power of the Hugo Awards in the genre. They know that. So, yeah, I think there's going to be a big momentum to fix these issues. Now, over the coming months, people are going to, hey, it's the science fiction fantasy genre. We're going to debate this at length until you're so sick of it, you don't want to hear another word. But people will push for this to happen, to change.
And the debate is going on right now on Discord, on
everywhere.
Instagram,
yeah.
and other places all over the internet.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter where you are. If you're on Facebook, you're on Discord, you're on Twitter, you're on Blue Sky, you're wherever. It is happening everywhere.
That's good.
Yeah.
And Jason and I are proud to have pulled back the curtain a little and opened some people's eyes to what's going on. That's what it's all about.
Are you going to continue reporting? I mean, there's new information or at least new conversations happening every day. Do you have plans to publish more reporting?
Well, if more information comes our way, I'm sure Jason and I will be teaming up again.
Yes, I really enjoyed working with Chris.
And I enjoyed working with with Jason, people have been asking which of you is Woodward and which is Bernstein.
How did you two connect on this topic? How did you have you two done reporting together before?
Oh no, we know each other socially. Jason lives in Columbus. I live in Cincinnati. And we've met and socialized at other conventions. And of course, we're fellow Hugo Award nominees. Yep. And I expect to see you on the ballot this year, Jason.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that. Yeah, and actually, we were at...
I've recused myself from the category. Yeah. After
and we should actually... That, you know, I was working on a column to commend Chris for recusing himself so that others could be nominated from the category when all this hit. I haven't been able to publish that column. But, you know, and we were at a convention in Detroit when the over the January 20th period when all this dropped about, you know, the initial, hey, wait, these nominating stats are weird. And we were talking about going, what the?
Yeah.
You know, so it's.
Yeah. I remember that weekend. It was. Yes. When the announcement was made and people started going to look at the nomination stats on the HugoAwards.org, word spread like wildfire right over. It was a convention called Confusion, which is held in Detroit and Ann Arbor usually. And Jason and I looked at each other and said, what the hell is happening here? Yeah. And we had no idea until a few weeks later.
Yeah, and then I had to spend that Sunday morning at the convention, which I usually don't like doing, writing up a report on all that was going on with the initial release, just because I was like, okay, I got to write something on this real quick. And but yeah, then a few weeks later, we're back in touch.
Yeah, and then Jason stepped in, and here we are.
Yeah, so
I should say that Diane stepped in, and then
here we are.
And I stepped in
as a closing question. Like it was mentioned a couple of minutes ago about, you know, somebody, an author wins a Hugo Award and the sticker gets put on their book. All three of us, we all know, we all have friends, we all have family that occasionally read science fiction or read a lot of science fiction, but they don't really care about Worldcon. They don't go to conventions. They're not really part of that world. How does what we're talking about affect those readers, those watchers of The Expanse and Star Trek? How are those folks affected by this?
I think even indirectly, you don't have to be involved in actual fandom or, you know, attend Worldcon for this to affect you, because this is hurting the reputation of the Hugo Awards. And again, like I said, the Hugo Awards have far transcended the science fiction and fantasy genre. They are known worldwide. There are issues with every award given out in the world, even the Nobel Prizes. Trust me, there's some major issues with the Nobels. But they are known. The Hugos are known. And if the reputation of the Hugos is being undermined, that is undermining the ability of the Hugos to help. Hey, look, this young author got nominated for their novel for best novel for Hugo. That helps that author find new readers. And if that is undermined, that hurts the entire genre, but it hurts new readers, people who aren't even caught up in there. And that's not good. That's why we, in my opinion, we have to fix it. Mm. Even if you don't like the awards and stuff like that, the Hugos are one of the best marketing tools for the science fiction and fantasy genre that has ever been created. We don't want to get rid of that.
Yeah. The Hugo Awards were created in 1953, first awarded at the Philadelphia Worldcon. And almost immediately, like the Academy Awards, you see the award, say, okay, I'll check it out.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the influence of the Hugo Awards has been so pervasive that you can't go a couple of months without Jeopardy referring to the Hugo Awards as a category or in a clue.
That's so true.
That's pervasive. And we don't want to lose that kind of influence.
Yeah, we have to protect it.
Exactly.
Well, gentlemen, thank you so much for spending some time with me here at Retro Rockets. We've got a couple minutes left for our listeners who were not writing things down at the beginning of the episode. Let us know where we can find you online. If you have any social media that you'd like to share, now's the time.
Well, Chris, you want to go first?
No, you go first.
Again, my name is Jason Sanford. I also write fiction. I publish my short fiction in a ton of magazines and places. You can find my link to my fiction at jasonsanford.com, jasonsanford.com, or just Google Jason Sanford. And I also write the column Genre Grapevine. Just Google it, Jason Sanford, Genre Grapevine. It'll pop up.
Yeah, so the second best source of news on the internet.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Chris Barkley, I write for file770.com. You can find it at www.file770.com. You can subscribe to a daily news zine that Mike sends out. I mainly work for Mike for free, and he seems to like the wage arrangement. So I'm also on Facebook. You can just find me. I'm just Chris Barkley on Facebook. Next thing I'm working on, I'm working on writing a movie, because I feel the need to make things up now. So the movie will never be made. However, the script will be published on File 770 sometime this year.
So I look forward to it, gentlemen. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you for the opportunity.
The Retro Rockets podcast explores the deep heritage of vintage and classic science fiction and fantasy. I'm your host, Andrea Johnson. Our show is recorded, mixed, and produced by Andy Robbins. John Wenger is our special consultant. Our music is by Meter through a Creative Commons license, and Carolyn Baker designed our logo. Thanks for listening, and join us again next time on Retro Rockets. Thank you.